Welcome to the Dublin Festival of History podcast, brought to you by Dublin City Council. In this episode from the Dublin Festival of History 2023, Francis Thackeray explores the attitudes and responses to poverty in 18th century Dublin. The citizens of prosperous Georgian Dublin associated poverty with idleness, disease and moral decay and sought ways to prevent foreign vagrants from infesting the city. One response was to found Dublin's first tax-funded workhouse in James's Street in 1703. Francis Thackeray is a former teacher, journalist and arts administrator. This episode was recorded at 14 Henrietta Street on the 9th of October 2023.
Thank you, Catherine. It's an honour to be invited to speak here in this house that I've been an admirer of since even before it opened, since the first idea came about. In this talk, I'm going to talk about attitudes to poverty and in the apparently prosperous and booming city that Dublin was in the period 1700 to 1800. I'll examine the problems that poverty posed for Dublin's affluent citizens and some of the responses from the city authorities and the national authorities to those perceived problems. In particular, I look at the significance of the most notable response to what was seen as a crisis, the founding of Ireland's first tax-funded welfare institution, the City of Dublin Workhouse, which was intended to remove the symptoms of poverty from the streets. A word of explanation, I'll be using words and phrases that are now offensive to illustrate attitudes of the time. Language changes over time. Some of these words may have been offensive at the time. Maybe they weren't. Maybe they took on that offensiveness since then. We don't know. Our perception of Georgian Dublin nowadays is of a prosperous place with great public buildings, wide streets and residential squares. That's the Georgian city that we now see, built by 18th century aristocrats and bureaucrats and developers who shaped Dublin into what became the second city of the empire. But that new city was to the east, and as the elite moved to their new residential city to the east, the old city, the city centre and the west were left to artisans and to the poor. So the actual Georgian city became polarised and divided, both spatially and by social class. 18th century Dublin was a medieval town in transition to being a capital city with a parliament, a viceroy, an administration, landed gentry, and the sort of industries that go to supporting that wealthy elite in a growing city. On the other hand, rural Ireland, with its disempowered tenantry, went through periods of recession and famine with high levels of poverty, which resulted in poor and sometimes hungry people gravitating towards a city of conspicuous wealth. The figures there indicate the change in size of Dublin over that century, going from a city the size of Drogheda, perhaps nowadays, to a city the size of Cork nowadays, over the space of 100 years, but tripling in population. I'm going to be talking about two very distinct attitudes to poverty. The first is an attitude that comes from a moral or religious perspective. To illustrate that, I want to look at some thoughts from an influential book published in Dublin in 1752 called An Address to Persons of Quality and Estate. In it, Robert Nelson says, "The lower part of mankind are not only in an equal capacity as men, but in a nearer disposition as poor towards the attainment of the happiness of heaven." In his view, honest industry to support the necessities of life frees the poor from the temptations of idleness. Poverty preserves purity by keeping pleasure at a distance and discourages the growth of passions. He asserts that the devil is most industrious in tempting the people with the most power and authority. But persons of quality can secure their salvation by the liberal exercise of charity. The circumstances of the rich make it easy for them to relieve and support the miseries of mankind. So even though they're more prone to temptation, they can buy salvation by works of charity. The well-off should impart to the poor the Christian knowledge to bear their circumstance with patience and resignation to the will of God. In other words, the rich can educate the poor to be happy with their lot. The book goes on to recommend some Dublin institutions that could benefit from the charity of these persons of quality. Places like the Dublin City of Dublin Workhouse that I'll be talking about, Dr. Stephen's Hospital, St. Patrick's Hospital, and so on. No doubt some of those attitudes inform the way those institutions were actually run. I'll be coming to talk about those institutions in a little while, but first I want to look back at the beginning of the 1700s. At that time, the source of support for what were regarded as the deserving poor, local widows, orphans, the old and the infirm, was the parish. The parish was the unit for support. There was a legal obligation on the parish to support the local poor, going back to the laws of Henry VIII, imported into Irish legislation as well. However, that support was problematic in Ireland because parish administration was based around the Protestant community. The Church of Ireland was the established church, whereas the majority of the population was Catholic. Parish support for the poor was also problematic in the context of a growing capital city like Dublin, with a large inward migration of very poor people. Not only that, but it was a Protestant-controlled city in a majority Catholic country. Local parish authorities in Dublin resented being burdened with the expense of solving what they saw as a national problem. As Dublin citizens saw it, the problems arising from poverty were caused not so much by the local deserving poor, but by the able-bodied rural poor who were coming to Dublin to beg and steal. Earlier, I mentioned the moral or religious attitude to support the poor, but another common attitude, as I'll be explaining as I go on, to solving the problem of poverty arose purely from self-interest. How do we, the rich, the well-off, prevent these poor vagabonds from invading our city? And that word invading, we see it, we hear it being mentioned in by Tories, let's call it. Nowadays, it's the same thing, really, in those days. In 1682, Dublin's Lord Mayor, Humphrey Jervis, referred to the scandal and annoyance caused by foreign beggars and idle vagrants. And he tried to solve it with a badge system, an idea he imported from England. Local poor in each Dublin parish would be given coloured badges, which would allow them to beg in their own parish only. The so-called foreign beggars without badges could then be identified and apprehended and sent back to the place they'd come from. He offered a bounty of a shilling for every unbadged beggar who was apprehended. Although badging systems seemed to be put in place through the 18th century in Dublin, Jervis's plan didn't seem to satisfy the citizenry, because 13 years later, a petition to the city assembly complained that the beggars are seen in great numbers in all parts of the city to the great dishonour of the government thereof and the disturbance of all the inhabitants. Sturdy beggars were bringing their children to beg at unseasonable hours, and their leaders and other idlers and vagabonds take the opportunity to rob and plunder houses when open to give relief to those troublesome children. In 1697, there was another petition from citizens. This city swarms with beggars who, for the want of learning to get their livelihood, are becoming a great nuisance and will more and more increase if some course be not taken to put them to work. This time, the city assembly agreed to act. It resolved to revive a solution that had been proposed from as early as 1680 to build and maintain a workhouse or poorhouse for the relief of the poor. The solution in 1703, an act for erecting a workhouse in the city of Dublin for employing and maintaining the poor, was passed by the Irish Parliament. The act outlined the need for the legislation. The continual increase of the poor is burdensome for want of workhouses to set them at work and sufficient authority to compel them to. So, under this act, able-bodied idlers found begging would be apprehended, detained, and put to work in a workhouse in the hope that the habit of work would make them productive members of society, and persistent idleness would be punished by flogging, imprisonment, or ultimately transportation. Poor children aged between 6 and 15 could also be detained and trained to work and later apprenticed out to honest persons, quote, being Protestants. Honest persons being Protestants. So there was a proselytising agenda to this project as well. It would involve strengthening the Protestant interest in Ireland. In future years, the annual petitions to Parliament seeking funding claimed that the workhouse was, quote, a charity peculiar suited to this kingdom, situated in a metropolis abounding with papists of the lowest rank. Disabled people and children under 6 were to be excluded from this institution. Essentially, it was to cater for the undeserving poor, let's call it. The workhouse would be overseen by the governors and guardians of the poor of the City of Dublin, a corporation with a membership of 200, including ex officio members like the Lord Lieutenant, the Lord Mayor, Assembly members, the Archbishop and so on, and also any person who contributed over £50 to the institution. So this was a sort of public-private partnership, as we'd say nowadays, an institution that the elite of Dublin hopefully would want to be associated with and to be on the board and to be appearing to solve this serious problem. Where was the workhouse? Years earlier, King James II had given 14 acres of land in James's Street to the city for a workhouse. And this land was now granted by the city to the guardians for the support and maintenance of the poor forever. To fund the institution, the Act outlined two new taxes that the guardians could collect. They were authorised to licence all drivers of hackney coaches, carts and cars, and even keepers of sedan chairs, for an initial licence fee of £5 and then an annual charge of 40 shillings. That's a taxi licensing system, essentially. A transport tax, you might say. And a second tax. Every household in the city and liberties would be subject to a charge of 3 pence in the pound on the yearly value of the house. That's a 1.25% property tax. Maybe you didn't realise there was a property tax 300 years ago. The charity would also seek voluntary contributions, donations, legacies, charity sermons and so on. So in October 1704, Mary Butler, the wife of the Viceroy, the second Duke of Ormond, headed out to the western edge of Dublin at James's Street with the great and the good to lay the foundation stone for Ireland's first publicly funded workhouse or poorhouse. That's the foundation stone, which I think is in the Dublin City collection. I saw it in an exhibition a couple of years ago on the Vice Ruins of Dublin. There's a map which you can't really see very well from 1730. It's actually an upside down map. The north is the bottom, so the west is on the right hand side. I just put it there for a reason. The yellow line over this side is the boundary between the city and the county. It's at the junction of James's Street and Mount Brown now. And the workhouse is just inside that boundary. Incidentally, at the bottom left, I just draw your attention, I'll show you a detail in a minute, is an image of the workhouse. I found this interesting. Maps nowadays will put around the edges prominent buildings in the city or advertising something all around. This map in 1730 is there's one building that's being advertised. This is before all of our great buildings that we now know of as Georgian buildings, the big public buildings was built, the forecourts and so on. So the workhouse, the poorhouse, was the building to be proud of, if you like. There's a detail from that map. See the yellow line on the right-hand side, the border between the city and the county, and the green, marked in green there, the poorhouse, just inside. There was a reason, incidentally, for it being on the west edge of the city. It was the main approach to Dublin from the Midlands and from the south, from a good part of Ireland. So there was an idea that you'd catch them on their way into the city before they even got to Merrion Square or Henrietta Street, for that matter. The poorhouse was built at a cost of £10,500. We're told that Mary Butler, the Vice-Reen, herself raised 15% of that. It was designed by Thomas Burr, the man who designed the Royal Barracks, Collins Barracks, the old library in Trinity, and Dr. Stephen's Hospital, to a design that was similar to William Robinson's design for the nearby Royal Hospital Kilmainham. In January 1706, 15 months after the foundation stone was laid, it was reported that 124 vagrants found in several streets were apprehended and sent to the workhouse. Over the next few years, the workhouse capacity varied from 280 to 320. I found some financial information on the workhouse in manuscript form in Marsh's library. These figures appear to relate to the time between opening, it says to 1710. I think it's from 1706 to 1710. But it gives an idea of the proportion where the money was coming from, the carriage tax, the property tax, which was being collected by the parishes, voluntary subscriptions, rents, they rented out land and a few other things. Earned income, they had originally hoped that there would be enough earned income to provide some support, but earned income was less than 1% of that 16,000. And you'll see there that of the carriage tax, 10% of it was in arrears, and of the property tax, 27% of it was in arrears. And there's where the expenditure was going, provisions, wages and salaries and clothing and begging. The accumulated debts was 1,500, and that's quite sizable. So despite having apparently secure ring-fenced funding, as the years went on, the finances got worse. Arrears built up, voluntary subscriptions died off after the initial enthusiasm, and the capacity had to be reduced. The institution always had money problems, and by 1725 it was threatened with closure. So a survey was carried out of the 222 people living there to see what would happen to them if the workhouse closed. Now, the workhouse had a good reason for this. They wanted to threaten the parishes that if you don't give us some more money, these people will all be sent back to you to take care of, to the parishes. The survey survives, and it gives a great snapshot of who is there. It names and categorises every one of the 222 people who is living there. Gives us a picture of who was living there. This profile of people living in the poorhouse wasn't really what was intended. It shows that 18% of the inmates had physical illness, infirm, bedrid. 14% were superannuates, aged over 60. 15% had a mental illness or disability, fits, mad, fools. 9% had a physical disability, and only 3% were adult workers. The schoolmaster, not quite sure why he's living in the poorhouse, unless he was a member of staff and had a right to live there. And surprisingly, I think from the pre-publicity, let's say, 42% were children aged between 6 and 15. Overall, 55% were female. The majority were female. So after 19 years of operation, what was learnt from this survey? In practice, the workhouse wasn't catering for able-bodied adult vagabonds and the work-shy. As its proponents had planned, it was catering largely for children and people unable to work. It was very expensive to run, and its financial problems meant that this model was not replicated around the country as originally envisaged. Only one other workhouse similar to this was built in Cork. The idea was, of course, revived 100 years later in the national system, the National Poor Law Union system. It was perceived to be mismanaged with no proper oversight by an enormous board. I mentioned a board of 200 people. 200 people can't manage anything, and that was one of the reasons. Most of those 200 people, they were either there because of their job, the Lord Lieutenant, whoever, people who never turn up to meetings, or they were there because they sort of wanted to be associated with a charity and, again, didn't have any interest in proper oversight. The perceived shortcomings of the workhouse resulted in a new act in 1727. This allowed for a slimmed-down structure, a smaller board of governors, including representatives from each parish. They wanted parish buy-in to this system. The new board would appoint a 15-member management committee from among their members to properly oversee the work of the institution. This act authorised the governors to collect the carriage tax directly. I'm not quite sure who was responsible for collecting it, possibly the parishes. And also to collect the arrears on the property tax directly. And I know that property tax was being collected by the parish because that was the administrative unit that had pre-existed. It also gave them powers to apprehend strolling, sturdy beggars and put them to hard labour for up to 4 years. Even with these 1727 reforms, it appears that the Dublin citizens were still not happy. Their unhappiness was expressed by Jonathan Swift in 1729. It has been a general complaint that the poorhouse, especially since the new constitution by Act of Parliament, hath been of no benefit to the city. The principal end of building the workhouse, I take to have been that of maintaining the poor and orphans of the city, where the parishes are not able to do it, and clearing the streets of strollers, foreigners and sturdy beggars, with which Dublin is more infested since the establishment of the poorhouse than it ever was known to be before. He also noted the unfairness that funds for maintaining the beggars, bastards and orphans are paid by the citizens of Dublin, whereas the country landlords of the places where these beggars came from don't contribute one bit. He claimed another abuse was that the parish beadles, effectively the police of the day, were not apprehending people. They were taking bribes from these foreign beggars, and many even ran alehouses and profited from the custom of those very beggars they were supposed to be arresting. Swift also cast some suspicion on the staff and management of the workhouse. He said, "Yet I confess, I have known an hospital where all the household officers grew rich, while the poor for whose sake it was built were almost starving for want of food and raiment." So that in 1728. There's a suggestion there of corruption, which is certainly supported by evidence from later inquiries and later problems. Another social problem relating to poverty was the issue of abandoned children and the killing of children. In 1707, the year after the workhouse opened, an act to prevent the destroying and murdering of bastard children was passed. It noted that many lewd women who have been delivered of bastard children to avoid their shame and to escape punishment do secretly bury or conceal the death of their children, and if the child be found dead, the said women do allege that the said child was born dead. We have no way of knowing the truth of that. That could arise from prejudice, again, religious prejudice. These are Catholic women and they're killing their babies. That could be there could be an element to that. The act allowed for the death penalty to be imposed on a woman who concealed the death of a bastard and could not produce a witness to testify that the child was born dead. We don't know to what extent the act was enforced, but it's probable that it contributed to an increase in the number of babies being abandoned and therefore becoming the responsibility of the Protestant parish. Again, individual parishes resented the burden that this expense placed on them, and the practice of dropping babies, leaving abandoned babies in neighbouring parishes, became common. Parishes even employed lifters. There was a name for the people who would do this, lifters, who would lift abandoned babies from one parish and drop them in another. In 1727, the legislation confirmed that unwanted babies were the responsibility of parishes, but authorised parishes to raise, assess or tax and appoint overseers to the care of babies until they reached the age of 6, at which point they could be admitted to the workhouse. The legislation didn't seem to help, so more legislation followed 3 years later in 1730. It established a foundling hospital as an additional separate entity on the same site as the workhouse. It enabled parishes to send along present and future babies that came into their care to fund the new functions of the institution. An extra 3 pence in the pound tax was imposed on the annual value of property. As we know nowadays, once a tax is introduced, it can only go up. The Archbishop of Dublin, Hugh Boulter, a governor, ordered that a turning wheel or conveniency for taking children be provided near the gate of the workhouse, that at any time, day or night, a child may be laid in it to be taken in by the officers of the said house. A revolving basket, you've probably heard of this idea before, a revolving basket would allow the mother to anonymously place a baby into this basket and ring a bell at the gate, and the bell would alert the porter to the fact that there was a baby in the basket. In 1730, 265 babies were taken in. By 1751, there were 978 foundlings in the hospital and 429 adults and children over 6 in the workhouse. In fact, the workhouse was now largely occupied by adults who had come to the foundling hospital as children, so there was little room, or no room, for the admission of new adult paupers. By 1757, 1,000 babies per year were admitted, and by 1796, that figure had risen to 2,131 babies per year into this foundling hospital. In scale, the foundling hospital became the most significant part of the overall institution. Now, in 1772, legislation merged the two entities under one management, the foundling hospital and the workhouse. In another clampdown on begging, the 1772 Act empowered the beadles, bellowers and constables of the city to apprehend beggars and have them committed to hard labour at a bridewell funded by the workhouse. Because, of course, the workhouse was getting that funding to do that job, but it was considered by then unsuitable to be having adult beggars coming into a house largely with babies. If beadles failed in their duty, they could be fined 20 shillings by the governors, with the funds contributing to the finances of the foundling hospital. The carriage licence fee was increased to £2 per annum, and the property tax payable to the merged hospital and workhouse was confirmed at £6, the two earlier taxes combined, on the annual value of every house in the city, liberties and suburbs. After the establishment of the House of Industry on the north side, which I'll be talking about in a minute, the Foundling Hospital and Workhouse was renamed simply the Foundling Hospital, and it didn't take adults in anymore. Though still had adults, because some of those babies stayed living there. Foundling Hospital was an abject failure. Though it survived from its first version in 1730, it survived for 100 years until 1830. In the 12-year period to 1796, 25,353 babies were admitted. 68% of them died. A 19th-century historian of the hospital described it as one of the most gigantic baby farming, nursing, boarding out and apprenticing institutions these countries ever saw. William Wadsworth. The picture there, incidentally, shows the infirmary of the Foundling Hospital. It was built by Francis Johnson in 1810, only 20 years before the institution was closed up. That building is still there. It's now Hospital 1 in James's Street. There are figures indicating proportions, those proportions who died. In that 12-year period, 25,000 admitted, 46% died in the nursery, 20% died in the country, 2% died in the family. I don't know what that means exactly. A total of 68%. Don't try a calculation, incidentally. That comes to more than 100%. Mr. Wadsworth, who compiled these figures in 1870-something, didn't realise I'd put them on the spreadsheet. Don't add it. Struck off the books is an interesting one, and Mr. Wadsworth couldn't explain it. 25%. It presumably means children who were lost, were sent to the country, were sent to foster mothers, and died, disappeared, whatever, 20. So it's possible that 68% figure is a conservative estimate for the number who died. 8% were apprenticed out, which was always supposed to be the intention, that babies would be taken in, taught how to work, and then apprenticed when they'd come to 16. Only 8% ever reached that. 1% eloped, which just means disappeared, ran away, and 2% given to parents. And just given to parents, I just have one letter that's interesting. You mightn't be able to read that. I'll read it. We saw from the statistics there that a baby who went to the Foundling Hospital sadly was unlikely to ever leave it. So I'm just going to look at this one letter of a mother who tried to get her baby back. This is a letter written on the mother's behalf in 1817, writing to the governess of the Foundling Hospital. "I certify the bearer to be the mother of Thomas Clarendon, which she herself left into your school 12 months, the 15th day of last November, was actuated by distress to do so in consequence of her husband leaving the country to seek employment elsewhere. He is now returned, treats her with all manner of ill nature, and says until such time as she produces the child, she shall not be a single farthing the better of him, as it is the only child he ever had. She is informed that you hesitate giving out any child without a payment of 15 shillings to get your own child back, which she says is utterly impossible for her to produce at present. I imagine you will not hesitate giving it, as I suppose you are overloaded with them." Yes, indeed. And particularly, as she says, the father is able to support him. These letters, there's 20 or 30 letters quoted in this history that was published in the 1860s, all very sad letters. And as I say, sad when you realise that they were all letters for mothers looking, parents looking for their children back, and very few of them ever would have. The Foundling Hospital continued to operate until it was closed in 1830 for a number of obvious reasons. By 1830, the proselytising agenda was totally anachronistic with Catholic emancipation. So there were Catholic voluntary institutions set up. There was mismanagement and corruption, that was infamous from various reports that were produced over the years. The reports were all produced. We know this nowadays. The reports were produced every few years. Scandal, scandal, scandal. But nothing significant. After 1800, things may have improved a little. Also, the project was too expensive. The tax went up to a shilling in the pound, as you might expect. It raised 8,000, but it ended up getting a parliamentary grant of 17,000. So the tax wasn't going anywhere near the high expense of running an institution like that. As we've seen from the 1750s, there was little or no room for adults in the workhouse. So the complaints started up again. This urban panic in Dublin, it coincided with periods of rural famine and depression. Famine would hit the country, or bad yields, whatever, and people would flock to the city, and the panic would set in among the gentry of Dublin. A notice in the Freeman's Journal in 1769 noted the city was again infested with a number of sturdy beggars and vagrants who will not betake themselves to labour, and who by their importunity obtain from the well-disposed that charity which the real objects of charity ought only to receive. Again, we have the allegations that sturdy beggars are getting charitable support, which rightly should be going to the deserving poor. Parish beadles were being told to bring vagrants to justices of the peace to have them sentenced to bridewells. The bridewells were refunded by the workhouse, again, because the tax was given to the workhouse to do this job. The workhouse passed on £100 for every vagrant in a bridewell to employ them and to buy materials, since the workhouse was already receiving that tax. This system still wasn't making enough provision, so in 1771-72, a new law was brought forward with the intention of introducing a nationwide poor law system for the relief of the poor and for punishing vagabonds and sturdy beggars. This time, there was a rebranding exercise. They were now called Houses of Industry. These houses would have two functions: to relieve those impotent poor who were too infirm to take care of themselves, and to lock up and punish the sturdy poor who chose a life of idleness and begging. The title of the institutions emphasised that work and industry would be expected from those who would be accommodated in order to part pay for the relief provided for them, with the balance coming from grand juries from each county, essentially the county councils of each county. So the well-off around the country would pay under this system, would pay for their own poor rather than the burden being placed on Dubliners. In the event that nationwide system never materialised, the Dublin House of Industry was established in 1773 on an 11-acre site on Channel Row, now North Brunswick Street, and there were similar houses of industry in Cork, Limerick and Waterford, but essentially the catchment area of the Dublin House covered 75% of the population of the country. Initially, the Dublin House was to be self-financing from work carried out, and by donations. The authorities hadn't really learned from the earlier experience of the other workhouse that it was never really going to pay for itself either. Within a couple of years of opening, the house was in danger of closing for lack of funds, but with the help of an influential cleric called Richard Woodward, a member of the board of the new House of Industry, Parliament voted an annual grant of £4,000 from 1777, and that grant increased in future years. Initially, the House of Industry took the remit to suppress begging and incarcerate beggars very seriously. It wanted to prove itself as being able to clear the streets of beggars, and it offered a reward for the apprehension of any beggars causing a nuisance. Here's a notice the House of Industry put in the Freeman's Journal, published in the Freeman's Journal in 1774, just after it opened. Whereas several vagrants practice going to houses of gentlemen and ladies that come from abroad or from the country to extort money from them by beating drums, etc., now the governor is being determined to suppress every species of begging in the city, do promise a reward of 5 shillings, good reward, sterling, to any constable or beadle for every drummer or musician, alleged drummer or musician, I suppose, he or she shall seize in the act of begging and deliver them to the proper officers of the House of Industry who are instructed to receive them. So obviously the beggars are now using noise intimidation to try and beg money. And that wasn't going to be tolerated either. Look at something about the people who are coming into the House of Industry now in 1807. As the years went on, the compulsion element really died away by 1807. Only 4% of inmates were compelled, 96% were voluntary, thereby by their own wish. 70% were female, and within that there was a disproportionate a number of women who, among those who were compelled to be there, who were actually taken in and locked up there. An explanation offered was that with the mechanisation of industry, men were replacing women in the workforce. I don't know how true that is. 41% of the people in 1807 were employed. 50% were from Dublin, 50% from outside Dublin. 61% were healthy. I suppose that's a change from the old workhouse, the other side of the river. But by 1807, there were other alternative charities starting up for the ill, like Dr. Stephen's Hospital, very near the other workhouse on the south side, the Charitable Infirmary, and St. Patrick's for the mentally ill. So there were other places for sick people to go. In some respects, the House of Industry addressed some of the defects of the older workhouse. People were allowed to practice their own religion. Inmates were allowed to keep one-third of their earnings from manufacturing within the house. In other respects, the patronising attitudes abounded. Regulation on diet, quote, diet was to be of a standard such that no one might be induced to burden the establishment from the prospect of receiving gratuitously support superior to what their labour elsewhere could procure. So they weren't to be fed any better there than they would be able to feed themselves if they had a job outside. For clothing, another bit of patronising. No clothing was to be provided for adults unless it was produced by their own industry, as clothes given freely were neither valued nor preserved, but generally commuted for spirituous liquors. If you give the poor clothes that they didn't make themselves, they will sell them to buy liquor. Again, probably a prejudice, a sort of a religious type of prejudice. Probably some truth in it as well. I've talked about the municipal, the state institutions, those two state institutions. Alongside those, many charitable institutions were springing up aimed at bettering the lives of the poor and needy. Many of the founders, inspired by religious or moral conviction. Between 1718 and 1750, the early period of the workhouse, the Charitable Infirmary, later turned into Jervis Street Hospital, Dr. Stephen's Hospital, Mary Mercer's Hospital, Dr. Moss's Hospital, the Rotunda, and Swift's Hospital, St. Patrick's, were founded. So in a fairly short period of time, all of those voluntary institutions started up. Voluntary effort by well-meaning individuals or groups, people of conviction, filled the gap left by the state authorities, which, as we've seen, were more obsessed with satisfying the self-interest of the rich and punishing people rather than genuinely catering for the welfare of people. It's interesting that of the institutions from 250 to 300 years ago that I've mentioned, those run by the voluntary charities, those ones I've just mentioned, they still exist today, even as a legacy. Some are in merged institutions, but they survived. They all survived until sort of 50 or 60 years ago, and they survive in merged institutions today. Whereas the two state institutions essentially failed. I started off by saying that I'd be talking about attitudes and institutional responses to poverty. So, in conclusion, I'd ask the question: is it because these attitudes and perceptions and prejudices were so mistaken that the resulting institution ended in failure, essentially, those two big state institutions? some final positive thoughts, maybe. The City of Dublin Workhouse did establish the idea that welfare provision is a civic responsibility, needed to be treated by a wider scale than just a parish, needs to be funded from a broad general tax rather than voluntary effort alone. And I suppose that's the point from which the modern welfare state has evolved. You might say the welfare state started with that idea. There needs to be a tax to support people's welfare. Secondly, in Dublin, even those awful institutions, two awful institutions that I mentioned, Workhouse and House of Industry, they've left us a legacy of sorts. The site of the House of Industry became the North Dublin Union when the nationwide poor law system finally came into effect in the 1830s. The site now houses a number of medical and educational and welfare institutions, including Dublin's newest university, Technical University Dublin. And over on the south side, the Workhouse and Foundling Hospital site was designated, which was designated back in 1703 for the support and maintenance of the poor forever. Now, 320 years later, that was 320 years ago. It became, in the meantime, the South Dublin Union in the 1830s, and that evolved into Ireland's biggest teaching hospital, St James's, and the site will soon house our newest and most expensive health facility, the National Children's Hospital. I just want to mention some of the sources that I used in devising this talk. A great book by Davis and Mary Coakley, The History and Heritage of St James's Hospital Dublin, published in 2018. I saw Dr. Coakley give a talk in 2016. He was writing the book, and it's fascinating. He's not a historian, he's a doctor, but the 500-page book is fantastic if you're interested in that space. David Dixon, John T. Gilbert's Calendar of Ancient Records, we all need for anything over previous 1,000 years. And the book I was referring to, William Dudley Wordsworth, quite a bit, some of the statistics and those letters came from this book, A Brief History of the Ancient Foundling Hospital of Dublin from the year 1702, published in 1876. It's available online. It's very interesting because things like those letters, they don't survive now. When the workhouse closed, I'm sure they were destroyed. So the evidence that we have is the evidence that man gathered in 1876. I want to thank 14 Henrietta Street and Dublin City Culture Company for inviting me, the Dublin Festival of History and Donald Fallon, who invited me to give the talk, and most importantly, University College Dublin and Professor Mark Cable, who supervised my research that led to the information that I've given you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Dublin Festival of History. The festival is brought to you by Dublin City Council and organised by Dublin City Libraries, in partnership with Dublin City Council Culture Company. For further podcast episodes and for all the latest festival news, be sure to visit dublinfestivalofhistory.ie or follow us on Instagram.